I always try to figure out what did I gain out of that experience, whether it went the way I wanted it to or the way I thought it did. But it's constant searching for that tuition so that maybe I make less mistakes trying that, or what went well so you can replicate it. But it's always just searching for what did I learn out of this situation. And I just think of my dad always saying, what's your tuition?
Welcome to the MediaCorps Minute Podcast. My name is Josh Langmaid. I'm your host. I run a video production agency here in Minnesota. Today in the studio, I'm joined by Matt Remick. Matt is the president as well as one of the owners of the Rochester Athletic Club. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm well. Thank you, Josh, for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was thinking a lot of the guys that I've had on the podcast so far, you know, we've done work with them, or, you know, it's been a couple of years since, like, we know them. I think you and I have only met once probably in person.
Yeah, once, maybe
just
twice.
Grab that just, coffee.
Yeah, pretty casual so far.
Yeah. So I was excited because I, you know, I get to learn more just about you, your story, and yeah, I'm excited.
Cool.
Before we kind of get into things, can you just tell listeners what is the Rochester Athletic Club?
Yeah, sure. So the Rochester Athletic Club is a multifunction athletic club, if you're using the industry, you know, jargon. But basically, we are a family focused club because we've got some youth activity space that's dedicated. But we're a full service athletic club. We have 260,000 square feet of club under roof.
It's huge.
Which is one of the 10 largest in the United States that I'm aware of.
I didn't know that.
So, you know, it works for Rochester, Minnesota. Minnesota is part of the reason why we have 11 indoor tennis courts, where in Florida you wouldn't need that amount of space. But, you know, we have a couple of swimming pools, a family pool, a lap pool. Beauty of those is we keep them at different temperatures so the kids don't have blue lips during lessons and the swimmers don't overheat. But we have basketball, full fitness floor, you know, free weights, cardiovascular. But one of the things that really makes us unique is we have a 35,000 square foot indoor family center called The Neighborhood. So we started that in 2006 is when it opened. Started thinking about it in 2004. My kids at that point were 1, 2, and 4.
Wow.
And it was just we didn't have anywhere to burn off energy in Rochester. So we started, and we were going to do just a little bit of it, a tennis court and a half, and we ended up taking 5 tennis courts to kind of do that.
That's
what makes us unique. And you know, it's intended for 8 to 12-year-olds, but certainly we have families who come in mini golf, different activities in there, that just a place to hang when the weather is like it is now in the winter.
That's right, when it's nice and cold out here in Minnesota.
And then when it's too hot in the summer, they got a place to play when their pool isn't what they want. So, yeah, just it's, you know, we get to just see people right now socializing, spending time doing what they want. It's just a good business to be in.
Yeah. No, I've been in there, I'd say, a handful of times, and the facility is just, it's awesome.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, you got a really cool spot there. So yeah, kind of jumping back, turning the clocks back a little bit into history. Now, it was your dad and a couple partners, right, that had originally started that. When did they start the RAC?
So the RAC opened in October
93. Okay.
Started talking about it in 1991. So it was a 16-month build. So yeah, I'm second generation. It opened in 93. I happened to be a freshman in college in 93, so I wasn't ready to work there or anything.
Right, yeah.
My dad was in the Kids Come First businesses with a couple of local guys, Rick Hexum, developer, Jeff Brown Real Estate, commercial real estate. And Jeff had gone to the city, saw a multi-purpose club up there, and thought Rochester could use something like that. So they did a feasibility study, met with a consultant, hired that consultant. His name was Greg Lappin. He came with a wealth of industry knowledge and connections. And then they contracted with an architect that's known for clubs out of Denver, Colorado, Hervé Lavoie. And he and Greg and, you know, the other guys came up with the model and started to put it into action.
That's great.
So it was also one of the wettest summers ever in Rochester, which made, you know, building such a sizable building take longer, get more expensive. So at that point, too, my dad brought in another or needed another partner. So that's when a gentleman named Mike Gostomski, who my dad goes way back with, they were involved in the starting of a little company called Fastenal out of Winona, Minnesota. So that's how it kind of started. And they operated, you know, we've done one major renovation, and that was adding the neighborhood in 2006.
So it was like always that big.
But it was almost always that big.
Wow.
We added the six tennis courts in that fabric frame structured building off the back. That's the only additional square footage. So we were about 185,000 square feet before we added that. That building's 43,000 square feet, but we added some mezzanining, if that's a word, when we built the neighborhood. So that's where some of the square footage went up to 260.
Wow. And there was probably nothing in town, really, that was close to anything like that.
It was, from my understanding, again, this is, you know, hearing from my dad, right. I didn't live it, but they were down in what was the Galleria and is now University Square, I believe, pre-selling memberships for 6 months before. And, you know, back then, they had this huge model built of the club. I believe at the time it was $35,000, which was the same price of a Cadillac. And I just remember thinking, like, holy cow, this thing is, you know, super expensive. But it was one way to help people visualize what they were doing.
Right.
So they were down there for 6 months. And if I remember the number right, they sold 900 memberships during that first 6 months. And then they had...
Just with that model.
Well, with that model.
And with what was going to... Yeah.
But 900 wasn't... The break-even was forecasted originally to be about 2,500 memberships. Okay. So 900... made the owners a little nervous. But, you know, Rochester is a little bit more of a need to see, feel, touch kind of a town. So once the club opened and they had just an open house the weekend before they opened, they sold 900 memberships in 3 days. So it was just the difference of, it was such a foreign concept for people that the model didn't, you know, give them the understanding of what it was. So, you know, I think the club became, you know, starting to be self-sufficient at about 16 months, which is pretty great for a project
that size,
that it was at least supporting itself. And then it kind of built from there, and there's been bumps along the way, just like any journey, but, no, they have pretty good foresight, and I'm not sure how many markets a club this size would have worked in, especially back in 93.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So you grew up in Rochester then?
I did. I was born, raised in Rochester. I went to school in St. Paul, and I lived in Winona for my just started my professional career for about 5 years. So I've lived in this little triangle of Minnesota my whole existence.
That's fantastic. What growing up, was there a time that you think that, just looking back, when you realized, hey, business and entrepreneurship, like, this is something that I want to pursue or I'm, you know, be excited about doing?
Yeah. So for me, I've always said to people who've asked, you know, I was lucky enough to have clarity early. I had an experience in seventh grade. I went to St. Francis and they had this school supply cart, and, so I wasn't originally operating the school supply cart. A couple of kids were, and it wasn't doing very well. So I can't remember the details of what happened, but I was offered the opportunity to take it over.
Yep.
And as common sense as this is, the first thing I did was I fixed the fourth wheel that didn't allow him to wheel it around, right? That's what makes it hard.
Right.
You can't really sell school supplies when you can't wheel the dang thing around. But I fixed the fourth wheel, and I started, you know, showing up at classes at the same time on the same day, so kids knew to bring money, and just some of those things, I guess, fortunately came natural. But I had so much fun doing it.
Yeah.
The supply cart was $70 in the hole when I took it over. We were $70 ahead within 2 months, and, you know, further on in the experience, the teacher who was kind of responsible for that project would let me order.
That's awesome.
And so I got to order, I still remember I ordered this really impractical but cool looking glue that I could sell for $4. And it was just, you know, at that moment I found something that I just really fell in love with the process and getting to see all sides of it. And it was just enjoyable. So when it came time to where do I want to go to school? College. What do I want to do? I looked for schools that had a major in entrepreneurship. I can't remember how many there were at that time, but in 96...
It probably wasn't super popular then,
I found about seven.
Yeah.
I applied to one. I got into the one, and that's where I went. I got out in 4 years. And just I've had this focus on owning and operating my own business. Now, it wasn't ever intended to be a family business because, like I said, my dad had started it when I was a freshman in college.
Yep.
I was really thinking I wanted to own and operate movie theaters. Mm. Having experienced an athletic club during the COVID pandemic and seeing movie theaters, I'm not sure if either one would have been a great ride over the last couple of years. But I still love going to movies, and absolutely, I don't want to mix that with what I do. So this is working great.
Yeah. So out of college, you graduated with a business degree?
Yeah. Business degree in entrepreneurship was actually my major.
And then out of college, where'd you go next?
So I went to go work at a company called Fastenal. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it before. Right. But
that was in Winona.
Was in Winona. Yep. The corporate headquarters in Winona, and I went to corporate headquarters. My dad and I took a family business class together at St. Thomas. So it was pretty cool. It was one day a week he would come up. And during some of that time, he had always said that it would be in my best interest and his best interest if I went to work somewhere else before I came back to the club, just so that I didn't come in anointed and that I had some experience outside. So I went to work for Fastenal, and it's, you know, and it's a great company. I love the culture. It's really about getting the decision as close to where it needs to get made as possible. So frontline people making decisions, the branches, you know their market better than somebody in corporate or wherever else. So it's really about, you know, getting decisions as close to, you know, the front lines as possible. So I kind of learned that there, but I did a bunch of jobs. It was growing so fast during the time I was there. I think I had 13 jobs in 4.5 years.
Wow.
So I started in purchasing. We launched the electrical line, and the welding supply line while I was there. So I got to see and start two different lines. Now, I wasn't the expert. They brought in, you know, a product manager for each, but I did the purchasing, but I also understood how the product needed to get to and kind of flow through Fastenal at that point. And then I ended, they were doing a computer system conversion, and I was a trainer for a 7-state region, and I was traveling quite a bit at the end. And that's ultimately why I left. I met my wife while I was there, and we were expecting our first kid, and I didn't want to be gone half of the time. So I called up my dad and I said, hey, do you have anything you guys need help with? And ironically, they needed a brand new computer system. And so I had familiarity from what I was doing. Yeah. So I kind of just slid over, and that was my first.
And then how long were you at Fastenal again?
About 4.5 years.
Okay. Yep. And then you made that transition.
Yep.
And so you and your wife moved to Rochester. Then you're both living in Winona.
Yep.
Okay. And then, so what year was that when you started at
2000? So I've been there in September. It'll be 22 years. But I had a lot of significant things happen in 2000. My wife and I got married early 2000, February, and then we found out we were expecting our first kid in April. Moved, changed jobs, relocated in September, and my son was born the last day of 2000. So. I became a dad, got married, changed jobs, all those things. But it just felt like the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you just a part of the Rochester Athletic Club before ownership's talk started?
Sure. So, I came in originally to do, the software. The club software the club had used at the time, they went bankrupt. I think it was a few months into operating. So they were running, from either early 94, late 93, through 2000 on software that was from a bankrupt operator. Now, fortunately, they had one of the programmers they could reach out to if they ever needed anything. But that's living a long time on borrowed time. So when I came to the club, I had to add internet, email. You know, they had a website, but more of a web presence. And then we just really started going from a Unix system to a Windows system and operating. All of the computers and everything, you know, had to get swapped out to Windows. So that took a little bit of time.
Yep.
And so once I kind of completed that project, I had got, because of the necessity of working in each department so you can kind of understand what they need, yep, what you're going to turn off or turn on for the software, I had a pretty good understanding. And in 2003, the opportunity came that I could start buying shares from my dad. So I bought 10% starting in 93. And, you know,
and he always,
my dad financed it, so I was paying him.
Right.
So I, you know, I bought him out in 2008. I bought out two of the partners, Jeff and Rick, so I bought their 10% each. So at that time I had 30.
So your dad was always the majority owner.
My dad has been the majority owner until I bought 25% from him to get 55%.
Yep.
And late, boy, I think it was 2018. And so now it's just my father and myself. So we've slowly over time just bought out the other partners. Mm-hmm. The last partner was just bought out by my dad at the end of 2020. So I have 55, my dad has 45.
Yeah.
So our owner's meeting is a little easier to just schedule.
Yeah. So how did that all go? You know, there's, you know, even my brother and I have a lot smaller scale right now. I've been talking about, you know, what does buy-in look like? Things like that. You know, how do you navigate those waters with, you know, family and, you know, other partners?
Well, my dad's always been, I think my dad is one of the wisest people I know, but always just been really graceful in this transition of a family business. Partners pretty much all had good relationships. Mm-hmm. It just, for the first two partners to leave, it was just the right time. You know, I wasn't, because I was still fairly new, I was 8 years into it, and they had a longer relationship. Some of those conversations happened between my dad and the other two owners.
Yep.
But it really just gave me the opportunity to buy that shares, and to, you know, they got what they want. And as, you know, as far as I know, the relationships are still amicable. Yeah. I see Jeff Brown at the club. Rick, he's up in northern Wisconsin, doesn't come back very often. The other, we bought out, the original GM had a small ownership. Mm-hmm. And when he left, it was kind of one of those agreements, if you're going to leave, you have to sell it back.
Right.
So my dad bought his shares. Buying from my dad's never been a problem.
Yeah.
but really, after I did that, I made a focused effort on our buy-sell agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And had a formula that my dad, myself, and the last owner had kind of agreed to. I don't know if any of the previous ones, because I wasn't a full part of that negotiation, used that. But our ownership has had a buy-sell agreement since I've been a part of it. But you need to look at those from time to time, because it was written in early 90s. And so we recently redid it. A few years ago, I was looking at it. Somebody could sell and whatever, you know, they were getting paid over time, but the interest rate that was called out in there was almost 10% that they would get. And I'm like, well, I would damn near sell to get a 10% guaranteed return on, you know, with the way things were at.
Yeah.
So we ended up reworking that to, it's a, you know, a full percentage over prime or LIBOR or whatever. But it's important to review those. You can't just set those and forget those based on what I've seen.
Especially, for longer term periods.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. No, I like that. So, I mean, is one of your goals to just fully own all of it, or is there always kind of going to be, you know, family elements to it?
You know, it's I haven't. My goal was to get the majority. Mm-hmm. Now, my dad's at 45%. I'm one of five kids. Mm-hmm. I don't have any idea. We haven't had this conversation. Whether it splits because it's a nice divisible number by five. Yep. And then, you know, I can talk to my siblings and maybe buy them out. I fully don't know.
Yeah, just haven't gotten to that point yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I wouldn't mind owning 100%. Yep. There's a part of me after going through the last couple of years of COVID where I don't know if I want to own 100%.
That's kind of nice to have a partner. Yeah.
Yeah, it is nice to have a partner because, you know, sometimes everybody only thinks about when things are going great and when they're going mm-hmm. well. It was nice to have somebody else in the boat with me when we were getting fired at.
Yeah. Fired at pretty hard.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's always interesting. I've had probably half the people on here. We're kind of second generation owners now. You know, is there an element of, you know, trying to make it yours or like establishing, you know, your thing? So it's not like, oh, you know, you were given this or something like that. Is there an element of that that you had to kind of overcome, you know, with being in a family business and a second generation?
No, it's, yeah. So I've always felt like I have something to prove, I had the advantage of being Jack Remick's son and being in the position to get this. Mm-hmm. But I don't know anyone who's worked around me would think that I take that lightly. I work pretty hard.
Absolutely.
For the business, for the employees. And in my opinion, if I can take care of the employees, they'll take care of the members in the business. So there is something to be said about, putting my, you know, stamp on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. My dad has been really great about giving me the freedom to do the things the way I feel they need to be done. And by that, it lends a stamp of what you're doing rather than me feeling like I have to purposefully put, you know, Matt was here.
Yep. Yep.
So the business has slowly transitioned to the way I want things to be because I'm the one in it. Mm-hmm. My dad, you know, comes in, checks on a couple of things, and I'm thrilled to have him included and to whatever capacity. But my dad is in his 80s.
Right.
He's earned the ability to focus on whatever he wants to focus
that's
on.
Right.
If some of it's the racks sometimes, great. I welcome his thoughts because he's a very smart man. But really, you know, getting into the second generation, I'm fortunate to be in a round table with some local business mm-hmm. people. Everybody's great. You know, the businesses are good. We can share good ideas, but we also get to see how everybody's experiences in the transition.
Right.
And I would say that it makes me grateful, not that any of them are terrible. A couple of them are rough.
Because there is a lot of family-owned businesses.
Yeah, and there's a dynamic to that and that people don't understand. Like, it can become the topic of conversation Thanksgiving. Hurt feelings can happen from business decisions where either somebody doesn't feel included or there's a win and a loss or, you know, some mm-hmm. of those perceived things that follow you to family events.
Right.
Fortunately, you know, my dad and I have had only a few disagreements. I've only almost got fired once, and that was when I changed credit card companies because I was promised a better deal. And I had done, you know, you call references, do those things. Now, right. It ended up being a complete disaster. We switched back within 45 days, but my dad was so mad at me. Other than that, thankfully, I don't think I've put my employment at risk. In 2012, it was interesting from my perspective of, you know, I've been there a while now. I'd been there 12 years. Mm-hmm. My dad had been there, obviously, the whole time. The general manager had been there the whole time. And in 2008, technically, I became president of the club. So mm-hmm. I was the general manager's boss. Just more in, you know, structure.
Right.
But we weren't necessarily operating on the same wavelength. I didn't realize, you know, how how difficult that was on me. But over time, I just got really frustrated. And I was feeling like, do I want to spend the rest of my time doing this?
Right.
I didn't exactly know how to label what was wrong.
There was no like clear, like, this is what's happening.
Correct. It wasn't just a clear cut.
Right.
This is the answer. Do this and this happens.
Yep.
But I think it was just a struggle of the transition of the business, really. And so I was getting miserable. And I really prayed hard one night. And I was just like, I need some help. Let me know whether it's my best path is to go elsewhere or I need a change, whether it's at the club or it's just me.
Right.
And literally the next day, the phone rang and it was a consulting company. And they're like, we have this person who will be in there next week. Would you be able to set aside 3 hours? And I was just like, okay. And it was one of those, really? Are you
right?
Like, does it really work this way? And based on my experience, it absolutely can.
Mm-hmm.
So I set aside time to meet with this guy. He came in for 2 days, and we had to, get all the books prepared and get some things.
Yep.
And his job is to sell you to a longer term contract, right?
Okay.
I didn't necessarily know that, but we got through the end of day one, and he said, do you mind if I give you a little homework? And I said, no, that's fine. He goes, just so you know, I'm a former pastor's son. I have a question. And he asked me a question. It dealt with Moses, the Pharaohs, and what the Pharaoh said about, the plague of the frogs. And the question necessarily isn't relevant, but I just felt like another nudge of, this is another, I've got to see this through.
Right.
So I went home feeling like, okay, I prayed for this. I'm getting my answer.
Yep.
I'm going to commit to go through with whatever the guy suggests. I decided to go through with it. They brought in a consulting firm. We did a few things. So we set up an executive team in addition to our director's team. So that, as an owner, I meet with the general manager, assistant general manager, HR, and finance director.
Yep.
And we kind of make the decisions on the business. It, again, takes me out of being the lone person.
You have to have a team at that size of a company. Creating that, yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
So that was one of the better changes we did. And we still all meet with, as directors, and because we essentially have like 12 small businesses and under one. I mean, we have retail. We had a restaurant. We now lease it to some people who are way better at operating a restaurant than I've ever been. Kids club, fitness. Like, we have all these segments of the business that some businesses operate separate. But having that structure of, that second team that we can look at, what is our dues strategy going to be? Or what is the structure of this need to be? We've done incentive plans. We've rewritten our values. So not having to do that alone was one of the best changes that came out of there.
And that was their suggestion.
That was their suggestion.
To put that 100%. Executive team together.
Yep.
Okay.
And who
put that together?
Who put that? Well, they recommended, based on best practices, what positions should be involved. So we started meeting.
Did you select the people, though, for the
positions? Well, the positions were already there.
Okay.
So we started.
You just kind of moved them up to this executive
team. Yeah, so we started meeting in this executive team. And at that time, we only had a general manager. We didn't have an assistant general manager.
Okay.
So it was the general manager, HR director, finance director, and myself. And it worked pretty well. It just made things a little easier, like I'm bouncing ideas off of. But that team needs to be tight. Your directors need to be tight, but that team needs to be really tight.
Absolutely.
And during that time, through what the consultants were doing, we found out it might be best if I have a say in who gets to be on that team a little bit. More than just inheriting the team. And so it just really, out of the time had come to a point where we needed to transition the leader of the club to be more on my team than on my dad's team.
Right.
And it just naturally kind of worked that way. So for a little while we were looking for the right people, I was operating as general manager, assistant general manager. During that time, I realized the general manager is meeting with 15 people a week.
Yeah.
that's a half hour or an hour meeting. Like, that leaves little time to do else. So right. I thought, we're going to need an assistant GM and a GM. So now they each see half a dozen to eight people. So we kind of restructured, but, you know, I've had a say in the interviewing and the hiring of those people. And now I can really say, you know, starting 2012 and going forward, it was my team.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's when we decided, okay, the club is starting to age. We need to have a plan of renovating this in sections. So we kind of worked through it. But some of the best decisions we ever made started out of just trusting my gut that this was happening for a reason, and to ride it out, listen to their advice, and just do my best to do it. And that was another thing my dad was really frustrated with me with, because it was expensive. But he let me do it anyways.
Mm.
And I hope someday, if my kids come, that I give them the same grace my dad has given me.
Absolutely.
So,
I really like that. What are since you know, you've been a part of the company, even with the executive team, you know, what have been some like highlights of things that like you brought to fruition, you think?
You know, really, so one of the things that we did was we went to Florida. We got out of the business to focus on the business. Sometimes you need to do that. And we updated the language of the company's values to match the team that was in place. Not to say that there was anything wrong with the values before, but we took some intentional time to go ahead and create what our values were going to be. And you know, every new associate orientation that we do now, every introduction to the department that the directors do, they go through the values of the club. And our new associate orientation, I am there, the general manager's there, the HR director's there, but I go through the values, and I go through them one by one. We have eight. And I just really say, if these resonate with you, you'll be happy here.
Right.
If they don't, you probably won't be happy here, and that's okay. Like, these are just how we choose to guide our business. But doing that, and then we hire based on our values. You know, certain jobs, you need skills that come along with it. But as long as the skills are equal, we've always hired the person who better aligns with our values.
Yep.
And it's just been fun to see that transition over time. Because, you know, when you have a change, like a new general manager, assistant general manager, you change the structure. Some of the people who are happy with the way things were aren't happy with how they go. So there's some natural just turnover over time.
Yep.
And now we have almost all our directors, granted it's almost been 10 years, are newer. And it's just been fun to see, you know, other careers, some have retired, but other careers end, and just seeing somebody put a new spin on something. So that's been really rewarding. One of the better decisions we made, we were at our big industry conference in 2013, and we're seeing all this new cardiovascular equipment. A lot of it functions the same, right? It's right. It's really about creating a different user experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Life Fitness had their stuff in their screens. Precor had their stuff in their screens. All of the major players had their new digital interface.
Right.
And it was one of those things I'm like, boy, if I remember the club and you... Because typically we bought the best treadmills that year. Mm-hmm. And then we bought the best ellipticals next year. And so we kind of had a hodgepodge of equipment. And so we would hear, you guys don't have enough of treadmills, whatever. And at that show, we started looking at what would happen if we were to lease equipment. Because we really thought, all of these now require a username and password, which we're not necessarily in control of recovering.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to appear like we're in control of recovering, although it becomes, you know, pre-course function or whoever. So we really decided, okay, we need to pick the best partner, and we're going to lease equipment and have new equipment every 3 to 4 years. We did three the first time. We found four just works better. There's enough changes in 4 years. In 3 years, there necessarily isn't.
All right.
But really partnering with one person and putting the member experience at the forefront of that, so that, you know, they need to know one username and password for everything. The other thing was, if you come and all the ellipticals are in use, you can hop on a treadmill or a bike or the AMT And you know how the machine works because you're familiar with the interface.
Same interface.
So as soon as we did that, we stopped hearing that we didn't have enough equipment. Like, it just stopped because I didn't
realize it. Some people just wanted their thing because of the interface. Okay. Correct.
So I wanted the Quinton treadmills, and you had six of those because they were the best treadmill that year. But I don't like the Life Fitness treadmill, so you don't have enough treadmills.
That makes sense.
That has completely gone away. And so looking at that, we needed to get a net increase of 100 members to make it a right financial decision and keep them during the course of the lease. Mm-hmm. We had 287 new memberships net that year. So new equipment is big in our industry.
Yeah.
And so we have new equipment every 4 years. There are enough
changes.
Do
the members know that?
I don't know if they know our cadence necessarily, but we do announce it. But, 4 years ago, they didn't necessarily have Bluetooth. So now with the new equipment, you can connect your... The speed of technology is changing where this really leasing fast. Helps us stay current, where the previous way we did it had some financial advantages. But having, 13, 14, 15-year-old equipment in the 90s to early 2000s, there wasn't as much change. You couldn't do that today. You'd look like a dinosaur. Mm. So that was one of the better changes we did, too.
I like that. I like the value things too. I mean, I think that's really important for companies, and even something that I think I'd like to even take more time on and focus on. Because there's definitely companies that are like, we live by these, we die by these kind of things, and there's like, oh yeah, this is what we kind of like came up with, and it's just on our website.
Yeah, we've really.
But I think used it is that important
as a tool to filter decisions through.
Yep. Because we were even working with Active PT, just finished a project with them, and Joan and Brian they're very like, we hire and fire by these. Like, these are who we are.
Yeah.
And so it's cool to see, and that's something that I want to do more of.
Yeah, no, we operate the same. And having done it with and without, I've found it much easier to just, and much more fun to have the business that align. We're all on the same page.
Yep.
It's good.
Tell me about the what was the kids club? What was it called again?
Oh, the neighborhood?
Neighborhood. Because wasn't that another thing that you had an initial idea of kind of?
So I can't claim necessarily the initial idea. I don't know who that necessarily belongs to. But somewhere between the general manager at the time and myself, we knew that our current 8 to 12-year-old space wasn't fitting the needs of what it should be. Mm-hmm. So we started brainstorming, okay, well, first of all, where do we put it? What are we thinking? And we came up with this decision of we had 10 tennis courts indoors at that time. We had a bank of 5, which are still 1 through 5, and then right on the other side was 6 through 10. We decided originally we were going to take a court and a half and add 3 courts off the back. We met with an architect. We started putting ideas together, and we couldn't contain all the ideas in a court and a half. So we ended up taking all 5. It's really the equivalent of, I think it's like 3.5 to 4, because one of the spaces is now our adult cardiovascular room, our adult free weight area, and then we mezzanine and put a preschool play area above it. But essentially, we took the equivalent of 5 tennis courts and just redid it. So we go to a show called IAPA. It's the International Amusement Park Association show.
Interesting, yeah.
It's in Orlando. We typically go every about 3 years. And we go to find a new idea and to bring something back. But the idea behind the neighborhood was really everything in here has to be activity-based. From a low level of activity, like we have 18 holes of mini golf, to higher levels of activity. We have these aero ball units, which are like trampoline basketball. You're in your own trampoline, so you can't jump into the other person. You have an independent trampoline, so you don't get the rebound where a lot of these injuries happen.
Yep.
But if you are in there trying to play that, after 7 minutes, you're like gassed. Maybe it's because I don't jump as much as I used to. But, we have batting cages back there. We have golf cages. So we have some sports-specific things. Mm. But it's really an intentional place for kids to come hang out and play and do activity. Because, growing up, I used to go with my friends, we'd bike, whatever. And we had more freedom than just people have. Like, we didn't allow our kids to bike anywhere when they were as young as I was, right? Yeah. So this was just kind of a safe place. And that was kind of the idea behind it, is have it be like a neighborhood where you kind of, we built in some physical houses and stuff, which, you know, one of them is the tennis pro's office on the other side. So we kind of use them, but it just makes it like you're coming, you cross the street and go into the park. And it's just been really good for us. We get to do camps in there. And it just really helps solidify us having a family focus.
I think I was going to say that. It's so important, just with, you know, the whole idea of who you're tailoring the gym to. You know, that's just such like a, I think so, you know, so many people are like, they want to work out, but then they have, oh, what do I do with my kids?
Right.
You know, and some gyms have facilities, but like, you took that to a whole nother level and you're like, you know, you can trust us. You have your kid here. You're doing your thing, and then they're excited.
And in some cases, we have the kids pulling the parents to come to the club, right? Yeah. Like, I want to go to the neighborhood, yep. And the parents are like, "Fine, I guess I'll go work out," which is pretty cool, you know. But we try to be, you know, not exclusively family focused. I mean, we have plenty of stuff for individuals to do, but it's also important. We have that basketball space, and I love watching, you know, dads and kids, or moms and kids, or even siblings drill and just do things to improve their skill. We have, you know, pickup games and all those things, but my favorite thing to actually just sit there and watch and just get some contentment out of is watching a parent and their kid shooting free throws or giving tips and just spending that quality time together.
Yep.
It just brings me joy.
Yeah, and I mean, you're in a unique spot to where, you know, you get to see a lot of families hanging out and, like, you know, doing life together.
Yeah, and now I'm old enough and I've been there long enough where I'm seeing, you know, some of the kids that we hired in high school are now there with their families, and they have kids.
That's awesome.
And that's so cool. Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
And you can tell, like, you're really making a difference there.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good product to get up every day and offer.
Yeah. So part of just business in general is, you know, we all have different struggles and pillars and, you know, things that we go over. You know, what have been some bigger things that have happened, you know, even recently, that you kind of had to navigate through and overcome?
Sure. So, you know, just figuring out how that transition that I kind of described earlier of getting, you know, my dad's team transitioning to my team was a big deal. But we also had, so that was 2012. Prior to that, you know, you had the recession in 2008 through 2010. Thankfully, we opened the neighborhood in 2007. Mm-hmm. And we had been working on it in January 2007, but we'd been working on it for a while. Dan Abraham's Healthy Living Center opened in 2007. So that really took that individual, you know, they got such a better value in some ways because it was being subsidized by Mayo Clinic, that, you know, we couldn't necessarily argue with them. Now, if they wanted, you know, the youth activities or you know, the basketball courts, some of the stuff that they don't have, we still had that value. Mm-hmm. So we had some people with two. But then, you know, you had the recession from 2008 to 2010. That was pretty rough. We lost, you know, several hundred memberships, but we navigated through it. I believe 1 year we operated the whole year, and I think our net was $10,000, right? And you look back and you go, first of all, you're grateful that it was positive.
Right, right.
But you're like, that's a whole lot of work by a whole lot of people for 10 grand. And thankfully, things, you know, got better from there. But, you know, COVID, well, here we are about 2 years later, right? Mm-hmm. My business was closed from March 17th through June 9th. And then again from, I believe it was November 18th through December 20th. We were closed 85 days of 2020. Up until May 18th, I had never seen the club closed 2 days in a row, ever. We closed on Christmas, we closed on Easter. And I really remember sitting there It wasn't dark, but we didn't have all the lights on because it didn't make sense to necessarily do that.
Yeah.
But trying to figure out how are we going to navigate these next 2 weeks, right? That's what we thought. But it ended up being a long time. It was 85 days the first time. And so keeping the team engaged. We were fortunate. We actually became debt-free at the end of 2019. So we got to woohoo for a few months.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But we were in a fortunate position where we decided to pay our employees at 80%, full-time, part-time. We looked at what they had earned in January and February, and we took 80% of that, and we paid them during the whole closure. Because one of the things we talk about is step up when it's your turn. It's part of one of our values, which is team rack. So it's being part of a team, showing up on time, doing those things, not leaving your teammates out to dry. But it was my turn as an owner to step up. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that was something we needed to do. My leadership, so the GM, assistant GM, kind of formed all these different committees on, who's going to control signage, who's going to control sanitation. And really my job was to be a sponge during the next several weeks. So I was on more webinars and more Zoom calls than I ever thought I'd be in my life.
Yeah.
But with other club owners. Again, I'm on a club owners round table of 15 people. We all learn faster because we're in there together. Some person finds this hand sanitizer is amazing. It lasts 24 hours because of the chemistry of it. So I didn't have to find that, but I can sure order it.
Right.
So we just worked through it together, being closed together. And some of them are closed longer, some of them are closed shorter. But one of the best things I would recommend is getting into peer groups of some sort. I'm fortunate to be in an industry-specific one, which is great, and one in Rochester, which is great, because it's like, what do you guys do for benefits? And then all of a sudden you get, eight opinions of people you value on what they do, and it just makes your learning faster. So as long as you're giving more than you're getting,
absolutely,
it's really a rewarding experience. But getting through COVID was a challenge. We operated 2020. We lost several million dollars just operating that year, because when we opened, the state set it up where it was 25% or 250, whatever's lower. 25% of our fire capacity would have been 900 people. We had to find a way to operate a 250,000 square foot building for a rotation of 250 at max at a time.
Wow.
And we didn't realize it really at the time that employees didn't have to count in that number. So we really were using about 210 until we kind of learned the difference. But just really taking the time and learning all you could and trying things. You couldn't be too risky during that time, but you had to find different ways to do things. One of the most amazing things that sticks with me is, we were trying to engage people with, video exercise and these things. But our kids club director got on Facebook, recorded her reading a book because all these kids hadn't seen her in a while. And, oh, my gosh, the amount of views that had or comments that had, that was just a really, we are connected to these members. And so we started to do a few more of those things. We did a outside drive through with Santa. So we had, Santa out there, but we had, you could drive, you couldn't sit next to Santa and get your picture, but you could get out, stand 6 feet away, and we had the bag of food at the end. But punting and doing those things kept us connected with our community, our members, kept the staff energized when they got to
probably
do those
kept
things.
Morale, like,
correct,
because that could be COVID could really wreck the morale pretty easily.
It's been, everybody is suffering from COVID fatigue that I know. Maybe there are some people out there who aren't, but we will get through this. We will figure it out. It has gone longer than I think any of us thought it would.
Right.
And navigating through that has been a challenge, but I really feel like when it's kind of done and we can all take a little bit of a deep breath, it's going to be one of the more rewarding things as we look back and reminisce through our careers, my director's mind, that we successfully came out of this. Because I can tell you right now as an industry, 25 to 30% of clubs nationwide are closing or have closed. It's been that rough on our industry. And it is what it is. You know, some industries have been harder hit than us. Some certainly have not. Some of them have thrived. And that's great. That's what makes business exciting to me is it's a different puzzle all the time.
And you were right away when you said the movie theater thing right away. I'm like, yeah, both movie theaters and gyms just got smoked in COVID. Yeah.
And restaurants. I mean, restaurants got smoked. Yeah.
Because there, I mean, there really was like 50% just really bad. And then some just figured out and we're in a unique situation to grow from it.
Right.
And, you know, you just.
And I'm envious would be strong. I'm grateful that people got to grow out of it and achieve success. My job is to do the best I can in my business and not really worry about other industries, but be grateful for that. And there's going to be times in my industry where we thrive and other people are going to be suffering. It just ebbs and flows. The longer I've done this, the more I realize that, you know, it was a great example of how little control you have sometimes.
Yeah.
And your response is, how do you react to that? That's more important than having the control, but your reaction to some of those things.
Because there's a lot of industries that would have been fine, but they were just like, nope, we're gonna sit back and just let it happen. And then there was like some that were like, nope, we're gonna change and adapt and do whatever we need to do.
Well, everybody I remember like thought, because originally it was supposed to be 2 weeks and we'd flatten the curve, right?
Yeah.
If you were just sitting around waiting for the 2 weeks to end and it took for us 85 days, that's a long time. Like we took those 2 weeks and we followed all the suggestions. It's like most of our people worked from home, but we had a building. I needed my maintenance people in there. We, you know, if something breaks, it could be a huge problem. But we were separate, but we were all kind of communicating and working on problems together to continue to roll something forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that didn't do that probably got stung hard. Yeah.
No, I mean, it was weird. We're in a spot where it's kind of advertising or, but like we had all these projects, you know, scheduled and it's just like everything just paused. Yeah. No one knew what was going on. It was like, nope, we don't want to spend any money on anything other than just like staying, you know, open or whatever, and or just in business. So we had a unique, just like, okay, who's still operating, and then how can we assist that industry for that chunk of time?
Right. But the fear as a business owner was real.
Yeah.
Like your initial reaction is, I got to hold on to everything I got, right? Because I don't know how long this is going to be.
And
it just took some time to realize that's not the right strategy. No. I can't just protect everything I got to have. I got to start moving forward in some direction. Mm. I got to be conservative. But some people in my round table of gym, they were advertising more while they were closed.
Right.
I didn't necessarily take that approach. We didn't cut our advertising. We just kind of did what we had planned on doing. But yeah, I mean, fear took over and probably caused me to make some real poor decisions until I realized that we got to move forward a little bit.
Yep. Got to keep going. What, other than, you know, well, let's get into this motivation. So, you know, business, entrepreneurship, you got to have a lot of motivation if that's, you know, family or success or, you know, your goals or things like that. But what is it kind of like drives you through things like COVID or like the struggles or even when things are going well, just to stay consistent on that path and, you know, grind every day?
So I would say I'm fortunate enough where I have enough internal motivation where I don't really have to manufacture it.
Yeah. Where does it come from?
There are some days I have to manufacture it. For a long time, it was proving that Matt Remick was worthy of getting what Matt Remick had for an opportunity.
Yep.
And I didn't just get it because I was Jack Remick's kid.
Yep.
And that still pops up from time to time. Even though I'm 47, I still sometimes feel like I got to prove I'm more than just Jack and Marianne's kids. And now, you know, having kids, you referred to as, my son is Jack too, but I have Jack, Susan, Megan, you're Susan's dad, Matt's, or Jack's dad, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But, you know, part of my value system that I've at least pushed onto my kids is do your best. So if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to commit to, you know, being an owner of the club at this time, I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. And I have to learn that sometimes the best of my ability comes with balance of turning that off sometimes. I'm not very good at that. Everybody who knows me knows that I'm not very good with downtime. That was my focus of 2021. It needs to continue to be my focus of 2022, because if there's a spreadsheet that can be worked on or something that can be done, I'll put that above hobbies. Frankly, I don't have any, and that's probably why. But I just have an internal drive where I really like to work.
Yep.
But what drives me to do what I do is I want to see my team succeed. I want to give these people that have committed to the Rochester Athletic Club to do their work the best opportunity to succeed. So I've got to give them the tools. I got to give them the effort to do that. And that's what, I guess, drives me now more than proving myself. Mm-hmm. It's not letting the people who chose to work there down.
Mm. I like that. You know, I think I had like the first bit of that kind of feeling when, you know, our team last year went from 3 to 6. And, you know, again, smaller, a lot smaller. But there was an element of like people are moving and like changing their lives.
Right.
To do this. And there's that, you can call it pressure, you can call it whatever you want, that it's like, there's an element of you're taking responsibility for like their livelihood and like you want to do right by them.
Right.
You know, so I definitely get that. And then on a bigger scale, like, you know, you want to do your due diligence to take care of the people that are letting you do what you know, what you do.
Yeah. I mean, it is amazing. Once you've had people relocate for you, for your mm-hmm. business, you're like, I owe them something.
Right.
Because they're changing their life to do this. And so that, I guess, is my biggest motivation, is I don't want to let those people down. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we have 300 employees during the non-summer time and 350 during the summer, 50 full-time pretty constant. I mean, that's a lot of people that are dependent to a certain extent that I make the best decisions or I do mm-hmm. the right things with the opportunities I have. And that'll keep you going.
Yeah. Yep. So just in your business and entrepreneur journey, what's like a big lesson that you could pass down or give advice to someone, who's maybe just earlier on in their journey, or, you know, further along, but they're just, you know, constantly, that's one thing that I love about business and entrepreneurship. Like, If you're doing it right, you've understood now that like you don't know everything.
Oh my gosh.
And that yes. you want to just continue to learn. And like I'm you know, not as far along as a lot of people that I talk to. So like I love being a sponge, but you know, even the guys I talk to, it's just like everyone wants to continue to grow and learn and succeed and be better. You know, what kind of advice or just anything that you've learned, you know, in your journey that you could pass to somebody?
So a couple of things. The peer groups for me have been very big, especially when things were rough. Like the peer group was fun when the industry was growing, everybody was doing great. But when things got rough, it was great to have people trying to accomplish the same thing, that we could bounce ideas, share successes, and just learn faster. So that's been huge. If there's opportunities out there for a business owner to do that, look for some of those opportunities. Get connected with other business owners, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's through the chamber, start there or whatever. But I think of one of the biggest things that, and this comes from my dad, and my dad is probably my biggest hero. He said to me, no matter what you try, if you're successful, if you're not successful, if you're, you know, depending on how it goes out, if you learn something, it was worthwhile. So he goes, when you get something out of it, it's tuition. So he uses the phrase of tuition because there's always a cost to trying something, whether it's financial, whether it's time, whether it's, you know, effort, emotion. I always try to figure out what did I gain out of that experience, whether it went the way I wanted it to or the way I thought it did. But it's constant searching for that tuition so that maybe I make less mistakes trying that, or what went well so you can replicate it. But it's always just searching for what did I learn out of this situation? And I just think of my dad always saying, "What's your tuition?" Mm. And I just love that.
I really like that. Well, that's awesome. Well, Matt, I mean, I've learned a lot. I think people listening have definitely learned or taken something away. I appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. It's just an interesting experience. I don't spend a whole lot of time sharing that stuff. Absolutely. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, well, that's great. Big thank you to your listeners, too. Just, you know, I hope you continue to learn and stay motivated as well. And as always, if you've enjoyed this episode, we just ask that you share it and pass it along to the next person. And we'll see you guys on the next one.